Life.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Movement.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Culture.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sasktel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International Volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and my special guest today is Dr. Stephen Yusuf from the U of R. Stephen is originally from Nigeria, so we'll be talking about some history there, as well as recent events relating to human rights. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
Really good to have you here, and maybe we'll start off by finding out a little bit about yourself.
Okay.
We'll work backwards. How you, where you went to school and how you managed to find your way to the U of R and that kind of stuff.
Okay. I was born in Nigeria and I grew up in Nigeria. Studied law in Nigeria, mm-hmm. and then later went to the UK for my postgraduate studies. Did my master's and also my PhD at the University of Liverpool in the north of England.
Oh, really? Okay.
I was in the UK for a long time, and I only came to Canada and Regina in November 2012.
Okay, so you've only been here for a couple of years, basically.
Yes.
Or just about 2 years.
Yes, mm-hmm. about 2 years. And I only started teaching and working at the University of Regina last fall.
Ah, well, welcome to Regina.
Thank you very much.
How do you like our winters?
Well, they say Manchester winters are very, very bad mm-hmm. by UK standards. I tell them they should try Regina winters.
But I imagine it's quite damp in Manchester, though.
Well, I've been told that, but I never really thought about the weather when yeah. I lived in the UK. I wouldn't wear any serious winter jackets. I just wore spring jackets and
yeah.
No hats and gloves and things like that. All of that has changed.
Yes. I was going to say, there are days you just wouldn't get away with that in Regina.
No, not in minus 40.
No, that's for sure. So how old were you when you actually left Regina? Nigeria, sorry.
Oh, yes. That was in my early 20s. I just finished my undergraduate degree. I think I was 22 mm-hmm. then. I just finished my undergraduate degree.
Yeah,
my law degree. So we left my family and I went to Manchester in the UK.
Right.
Yeah.
So you spent quite well your teenage years there, basically.
Yes. Yes. In so Nigeria. So
you'd be really aware of the stuff that was going on at the time, and that.
Oh yes, I was aware of that. There were a lot of forms of agitation by student union bodies and all kinds of activists mm-hmm, when mm-hmm. I grew up. So yes, I am aware of the history with the military and things like that. Yes.
So how would that affect your day-to-day life? Would you be sort of kind of looking over your shoulder type of thing during parts of your day, or
for the most part, no.
Right.
Pretty much, I was lucky. I'm a middle class boy. I mm-hmm. was lucky, born into a relatively well-off family. Not well-off, but mm-hmm. we were doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Surrounded by university professors, lived in that kind of community, and security wasn't too big of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that,
right.
Just say a taxi ride away, you mm-hmm. could be in some very, very bad parts of town.
Right.
So, and also you didn't want to be involved in too much political activities then.
That was my next question.
Oh yes, mm-hmm. Because the military would come after you.
So you sort of stick to your studies and. Not exactly turn a blind eye, but not make your own personal opinions known.
I actually did involve myself to some extent in mm-hmm. some political activities, but I was more, I've always been a bit of a hermit rather than
okay.
Someone that actually goes out and do a lot of things. But yes, I involved myself in some political activities related to student unions and human rights and
mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. But yeah, it was a time in Nigeria when I was doing my undergraduate studies where it was very dangerous to be a political activist.
Mm-hmm,
and I'm
mm-hmm.
sure you're aware of this, all the things that happened to some prominent political activists in Nigeria, Ken Saro-Wiwa,
right.
With the Ogoni people and all the brutalization and human rights violations that took place then.
Yeah.
And many, many student union activists felt the full brunt of the military regime as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you find that as a result of the political action that you were able to do? Do you think your groups had any effect on the government's approach to issues of the day, or were they just kind of not paying attention to you?
It felt as if they weren't paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to measure success when you're doing that kind of work or when you're trying to have a better society. But I think the combined effort of people both within Nigeria and outside Nigeria must have had some impact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The military had always promised they would help transition to civilian rule, but it was usually false promises and most of their promises were never brought to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
But towards the end of the 1990s, it did come to fruition. Nigeria did have a transition to a civilian government.
Now, a lot of the, of course, there are always things when you. Let's talk about the good things about Nigeria.
All right.
Okay. We'll start off there. And what would you say were the, if somebody were to visit Nigeria, what would they notice that was particularly beautiful, that sort of thing, the music, etc.?
Oh, the music scene is extremely interesting. At the moment, there is a lot of the usual stuff, youth hip-hop and things like that. But there are some Nigerian artists who are conscious about things like human rights, and they are incorporating that into their music. Some people have been doing it for a long time, mm-hmm. In the tradition of Afro beats. I'm not sure if you've mm-hmm. heard. So Fela started things off when it comes to Afro beats. But you have people like Lagbaja in Nigeria at the moment, mm-hmm. also using their music for positive things. In the southwest of Nigeria, education is an important thing, so you will find many educated people. Just another positive mm-hmm. To say about Nigeria. In fact, there's a joke among in many African countries that if you say throw up a cap, it will probably land on the head of a professor in Nigeria, because there are just so many, and sometimes, oftentimes, Western educated people. Especially in the south of mm-hmm. Nigeria, right. Not so much in the north.
Right.
Well,
we've thinking about the north here. This is where an awful lot of the unrest is happening.
Yes, that's correct. That's where Boko Haram is wreaking havoc, mm-hmm. and this goes back a long way back to the era of colonialism in Nigeria. Before Nigeria became independent, many northern leaders were worried that the north would actually lag behind, because the south was, mm-hmm. In terms of education, advanced. It was more westernized, more mm-hmm. Christianized, mm-hmm. and the north was mainly Muslim. Mm-hmm. So that was always a worry mm-hmm. that. On the one hand, there were worries about westernization and Christianization of the north. On the other hand, there was also a fear of too much of the fact that, well, the north is actually lagging behind.
Mm-hmm.
So
economically.
Economically, in many respects, yes.
Yeah. This is not to say that if you're Muslim, you're not going to be educated or...
Not at all. Yeah. So the northern elites will send their children to very good schools.
Mm-hmm.
But in general terms, that's a big problem. Education in the north is a big problem. Many people feel that the northern parts of Nigeria are generally lagging behind in when it comes to education. In the south, you don't actually have to be rich. Many people in, mm-hmm. in the south are well educated, but not probably by Canadian standards mm-hmm. with many people, but even by Western standards, so many people in the south are doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been that disparity.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
One source of troubles I know in Nigeria has been the oil fields.
Oh yes.
And has that improved? Let's go back. You mentioned the name
Ken Saro-Wiwa.
Yeah.
Right.
He was involved with protest with regard to the way people were being treated at that time.
Oh yes. Ken Saro-Wiwa founded organizations to help the Ogoni people, who mm-hmm. are one of the many groups of people in the Niger Delta area of Nigeria. This is in the south of the country.
Right.
And that's where the oil is. That's where the oil companies are. That's where the pollution is affecting many lives and people's livelihood.
Yeah, just an aside here. This seems to be a worldwide problem, where you have international corporations coming in and exploiting a country's resources, and not paying too much attention to the people whose lands are being exploited for this purpose.
Oh yes, that's very true. Only last semester, I taught a course called Introduction to Justice Studies, and I introduced my students to some of the problems that we're having here in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So the Amjuang community in Sarnia, Ontario, are facing the same problems that the people in the Niger Delta are facing. So the oil industry mm-hmm. has established there what's called the Chemical Valley.
Oh, yes.
And so you've got all kinds of pollution affecting people,
mm-hmm.
affecting people's children,
right.
The wildlife there is dying, birds are dying, the water is polluted. Mm-hmm. It's the same all over the world. And just as you said about the role of international corporations, I think the problem is that wherever they go, there seems to be a deficit of democracy because they tend to either hijack the government mm-hmm. or to be so powerful that the governments think they can only kowtow to what they
sure.
want.
Yeah.
So in the case of Nigeria,
right.
That's been a problem. WikiLeaks, for example, revealed mm-hmm. that the Nigerian government was being spied on by these big oil companies, and
right.
they knew what they were going to do
sure.
Even before some government officials knew about what government plans were. So how do you regulate such mm-hmm. Corporations in those circumstances?
Yeah.
In the case of Canada, the US, and the UK, and advanced Western countries, it may not be that bad, but even then, we know corporations still wield a lot of power. That's why some people would describe almost all of the countries that we hold up as being the paragons of democracy
mm-hmm.
as
right.
actually plutocracy. Okay. Because
right.
it's the rich and powerful corporations that are calling the shots.
Right.
If you have policies that go against their interests, they can always threaten you with capital flight and things
oh,
like
sure.
that.
Yeah.
And they just channel all of the policies to favor them.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just thinking of an example in northern Alberta. We have the Lubicon Cree,
mm-hmm.
And part of their lands is part of where the oil sands, they don't like to call it tar sands, the oil sands are, and they don't have a treaty. They're mm-hmm. one of the bands in Canada who don't have a treaty, and negotiations for the use of their land for the purpose of mining for these oil sands, they've been ongoing for decades, and without success. Without
yes.
success.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, even though there's no treaty, governments and corporations have gone in there, and if you've seen pictures, it's utter devastation. It really is.
Yes, it is sad. In the case of Sanya Otari that I told you about
mm-hmm.
earlier, the Chemical Valley is actually situated on Aboriginal land.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I was unaware of that.
That's really, really, really...
Mm-hmm.
It's a bad situation there, with some of the residents having to fabricate their own equipment to detect pollution, to detect gas being released into the atmosphere,
right.
toxic, quite toxic gas. And you just wonder, how come these people who are just individual citizens, how can they organize
yeah.
and manufacture equipment that can detect all of these leaks when these oil giants
right.
Aren't able to use their sophisticated equipment to actually do something about the problem?
There's a huge gap there, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
An acquaintance of mine from many years ago told me he was working in Sarnia, and he was taking air quality measurements for some situation, and he was attempting to zero his meter, and he was having trouble with it. He was a Saskatchewan boy in Sarnia,
mm-hmm.
so he didn't understand what was going on. So he asked his supervisor what was wrong with his meter, and he said nothing. The air down there is so bad they couldn't zero their meter to take proper measurements of pollutants.
Sad.
So, and that's some years ago. Hopefully it's improved. I wonder. Mm-hmm. From what you're telling me, it hasn't improved much.
No, not very
this
much.
This is our own country in the wonderful province of Ontario. Yeah. So while we're talking about Nigeria, we certainly the situation's really there as far as extraction of natural resources isn't much different in Nigeria than it is any place else in the world.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
And it's still the same problem of actually holding these corporations accountable,
mm-hmm.
holding them accountable, because sometimes in what are regarded as the backwater parts of the world, it's so easy for them to get away with human rights abuses that they can't get away here in Canada or in the UK or in the US. So Chevron, for example, was involved in a lot of human rights abuses. Some protesters got on one of the Chevron platforms in the 1990s, and they were peaceful protesters. But because these oil companies have the government in their grip, Chevron just brought in members of the Nigerian military through, they brought them in with Chevron helicopters, gave them guns, and they were able to just carry out all kinds of atrocities, shoot people and things like that, and wound people.
Yeah.
So many of these oil companies actually have their own standing private armies. In Nigeria, and that's a big problem because the government should be able to regulate companies like that. The government shouldn't be in bed with them, but in most cases, that's what we find, that the government can't regulate them because they're in bed with them. They have joint oil ventures, so there's the problem of independence.
Yeah,
and
they don't want to regulate them.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Yes. I had a thought and it escaped me.
Okay. Oh yes.
I was going to mention. We had a conference. I don't know. You may have still been here. Provincial conference of Amnesty International at the university. We were at. I think we were at Luther.
Okay.
And one of our session leaders was talking about ways you can raise public awareness about things like this. And what they did, this was in Winnipeg, they got a group together and took a picture with a Shell gasoline station in the background and talking about the atrocities that, Shell is very much in Nigeria as well. And with the oil industry.
Oh, yes.
And so they had a lovely picture of this protest with a Shell station in the background. And, with social media, now you can put that sort of stuff on and it gets people's attention.
Attention,
and,
yes.
And hopefully we'll go some distance in making people aware that, big corporations like Shell, like Chevron, are not nearly as friendly as they pretend to be.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And there have been many reports actually telling the truth of what's happening in the Niger Delta in Nigeria, both by Amnesty International and also by Human Rights Watch and many other organizations. Also, there have been many lawsuits filed in Nigeria, but they tend to come to naught, really. Where the promises seems to be with international lawsuits. So there have been a number of suits in the U.S. And Shell had to settle with large sums of money. Well, not large by Shell standards, but
they lost
something for something for the people. Also, the same thing in the U.K. There have been lawsuits brought by international lawyers to help draw attention to the problem and give some compensation to some people. Yes,
it is heartening that the courts now seem to be inclined to hear these cases.
And, oh yes, there was a time when the issue called locus standi, the issue was always, well, we shouldn't be hearing these cases.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's out there in Nigeria or it's out there in some other part of the world.
Yeah.
What's that got to do with us here?
Yeah.
But that's changing to some extent. Maybe not changing as fast as
because we would your players hope. Are in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a reasonable thing to go after them in the UK.
In the UK.
Yeah.
And also that's where you actually have judicial independence, sufficient judicial independence.
Right,
that
right.
will actually make a difference. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is the issue of judicial independence. That also affects human rights. If you're talking about human rights abuses by the Nigerian military as they try to crack down on Boko Haram, So they try to crack down on Boko Haram. They end up committing all kinds of atrocities on villagers and not distinguishing between who the actual perpetrators of terrorism are. And you have all kinds of things being done by the government, whether in terms of corrupt. You need a strong judiciary, don't you? But with developing countries, it's always a problem whether the judiciary is independent enough.
I know some groups down in South America have brought similar suits against Canadian companies in Canada, and successfully.
Oh, that's
even
good.
Even though the government has lobbied against that, and that brings up another issue. When you're talking about judicial independence, there's been some conflict. It's not automatic just because we're in Canada. You know, there was some conflict between the Prime Minister and the head of the Supreme Court of Canada here just recently.
Oh, yes.
And so, you know, we shouldn't be complacent and feel that just because we live in Canada that everything's fine.
Of course, of course. It's good to criticize the judiciary, certainly private citizens, journalists, and law professors and the like should certainly criticize the judiciary if they think there is something to be criticized.
Yeah.
But yes, I do get your point. I have a problem with the government being seen as a critic of the judiciary. Not that it's wrong for politicians to criticize, but there's a problem where of people suspecting, look, there may not be sufficient independence here. The judiciary can't enforce its own judgments. They rely on the executive. So the executive has to keep some distance. You've got to let the judiciary do their thing. The executive and politicians are very, very sensitive to what the majority thinks. All right. So not everything that comes from them is actually human rights respecting. But with judges, that's the special role we've given judges to defend the rights of minorities. So it shouldn't matter whether majority opinion is likely to sway politicians one way or the other when it comes to people's fundamental human rights. So that's why the executive has to just back off to some extent, because they are sensitive to majoritarian pressures. Okay, every 4 or 5 years or so, they've got to face the people and see if the majority still want them to be there. But with judges, we've given them this role of protecting people's rights, so that if all of Canada is against a particular thing, if we can bring that thing within the concept of the fundamental human rights of that particular individual, then all of Canada has to lose at the court of law. That's how it works when it comes to human rights. And this act, this whole issue of the role of judges in being to some extent against the majority will, and how that is important for the protection of human rights, is actually relevant to what's happening in Nigeria. You would have probably heard about the anti-gay law that they've brought out in Nigeria. And most Nigerians that I talk to about this always say something like, but majority of Nigerians are against homosexuality. Majority of Nigerians don't understand homosexuality. They think it's an African. They think it's disgraceful and things like that. And what I tell my Nigerian friends all of the time is, it shouldn't matter, okay, whether most people aren't in favor of homosexuality is irrelevant when we're talking about people's human rights. So people shouldn't have a vote on that. People shouldn't be voting to outlaw people's fundamental human rights. So that's just the way things work when it comes to human rights. And again, is the Nigerian judiciary sufficiently independent to stand up for the rights of gay people in Nigeria? That's a problem. I don't think so. I think that they're too interwoven with the government. And will probably just render judgments that will, if you ask me, will actually violate the Nigerian constitution as it stands.
I'm talking with Stephen Youssef from the U of R. We're talking about human rights in Nigeria and other places around the world. And it's time for a break, so we're going to do that. And following the break, we've got some music from Nigeria that Stephen will talk about when we come back.
everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come, army, they come. Confusion everywhere. Seven minutes later, all don't cool down, brother. Police don't go away, army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular Satan.
Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular Satan.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular Satan.
That is why everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Someone nearly died. Some people lost some bread. Someone just died. Police they come, army they come. Confusion everywhere. Seven minutes later, all don't go down, brother. Police don't go away. Army don't disappear. Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular Satan.
Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular Satan.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular Satan.
La 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 la. My people say they fear too much. We fear for the thing we know see. For freedom, we fear to fight for liberty, we fear to fight for justice, we fear to fight for happiness. We always get reason to fear. We no one die, we no one wound, we no one pinch, we no one go. I get one child, my mother different house, my father for house. I won't build a house, I don't build a house, I no one pinch, I won't enjoy, I no one go. So policeman go slap your face, you know, go talk. Army man go weep, don't ya, she go, they look like donkey. Rhodesia, they do them own, all it last they have for nothing. South Africa, they do them home. Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
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 Regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
That is why everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Police they come, army they come. Confusion everywhere. Ah, and so. Time where they go. Time no wait for nobody. Like that. Ah. But police go to come. I mean go to come. With confusion. In style. Like this. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police they come, army they come. Confusion everywhere.
And we're back, and that was an artist by the name of Fela Kuti.
Yes, Fela Kuti.
And tell us about Fela Kuti and what he's talking about there, and is basically a protest song.
Oh yes. That song is called Sorrows, Tears and Blood. And so Fela Kuti was just talking there about the many human rights abuses that usually follow in the wake of police intervention, military intervention. So there may be trouble somewhere and the government has called the police to intervene or the military to intervene. And he says... sorrows, tears, and blood are their regular trademark.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So their regular trademark, according to the song, is sorrow, tears, and blood. That's what they leave in their wake.
Right.
So when the police leave, people will usually cry, and there'll be a lot of blood spilled.
Right.
So Fela Kuti comes from a prominent Nigerian family. I believe Fela Kuti's mother was probably the very first feminist in Nigeria, one of the most prominent trade unionists and social activists before independence.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a cleric, and that family was generally involved in the pro-independence movement. And some of them have also been involved in human rights causes since Nigeria gained independence. Fela himself was sent to the UK to study medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Two of his brothers are medical doctors.
Wow.
He was sent to the UK to study medicine, but got to the UK and switched to music. So his music is usually a conveyor for his ideas about human rights and his anti-corruption stance
mm-hmm.
against the government. He was victimized by many military regimes in Nigeria. I believe his mother was actually killed by the military in
wow.
the end. And he himself was beaten up many times. And his so-called Kalakuta Republic is kind of joint where he
mm-hmm.
plays music and
right.
Kind of organizes protests and the like, was also raided many times
mm-hmm.
by the military.
Is he still active, still around? Or?
Oh, he is dead. He has been dead for some time. I believe he died in 1995. Oh,
okay, so he's
yes.
been gone for a while.
Oh, yes, he's been gone for a while.
But I got that music off YouTube, and it has an awful lot of views still.
Oh yes,
still a very I take it still a very popular.
Oh yes,
figure.
Known all over the world for his invention of Afrobeat.
Ah,
that style of music.
Right,
is good. I think it's a fusion of traditional African music, Nigerian Yoruba music, and jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so. Be prepared to listen to a lot of trumpets and the like and saxophone when you listen to Fela.
Mm-hmm,
good music. Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting, when you're trying to do something about an ill in your country or in any country, in any situation, often it's the artists that are taking the lead.
Oh, yes, that happens a lot of times. And a relative of his, by the way, a professor called Wole Soyinka, is either the very first African to win a Nobel Prize in Literature or the second.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the first West African to win a Nobel Prize in Literature, is also someone that uses his art to address the ills
mm-hmm.
in Nigerian society and also in Africa in mm-hmm. general. Wole Soyinka is a playwright, an author, an
mm-hmm.
activist, and also a professor. Yeah,
and I think comedy too is an effective weapon against that kind of oppression.
Oh yes, people use that all of the time, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Mm. There are ways, but sometimes it takes a while for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the North and what's happening up there. What's your sense of how things have progressed, or have they progressed?
I don't think they have very much. Things are still quite dire in the,
mm-hmm.
in the North. So the problem is multifaceted. You've got ethnic tensions resulting from the fact that some people in the North think it's a Southerner, a Christian, who is now leading the country,
oh, okay.
and that's seen as a problem.
Sure.
And in a way, some people are maybe a bit wistful of the military regime.
Mm-hmm.
Wistful, that's surprising because
yeah.
During the military era, all of these problems, according to some people, wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
People taking protests too far and engaging in vandalization. And you've got Islamic groups starting and engaging in all kinds of atrocities. The military would have dealt with all of this, is what some people are saying. Obviously, we know the downside to that, that the military wouldn't go through regular judicial means. It's usually extrajudicial, and they themselves are perpetrators of human rights abuses. Yes, the problem in the North, I think, all started after the transition to civilian rule in 1999. Mm. So, with transition to civilian rule, even in a country like Nigeria, there will be some political liberalization. So there was that liberalization of the of politics, and groups that never had a voice felt more confident to come out and stake their claims. Mm-hmm. So in the Niger Delta area, in the south-south, the group called MEND, Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, was formed. Some of them engaged in vandalization. But at the back, I mean, with MEND, in the end, you think there is at least some justification for the outcries and for the complaints of those people.
Well, that sort of thing, would that be like to improve the situation of the people?
Improve
who are
the situation
on the Delta?
There. Yeah, there are better ways, of course, of going about things. But you at least know where they're coming from. You know it's because of the atrocities that have been committed by successive Nigerian regimes, because of the lack of empathy by the oil companies.
Exactly.
What they're not doing enough for the people. They're taking all of the money from the oil revenues and all of that. So you've got that in the south, and in the north, you had all kinds of movements wanting Sharia law and the like. So ultra-Islamist groups started staking their claims. All of these groups, whether environmental movements who go too far and engage in activities they shouldn't be engaging in favor of protecting the environment, or in the north where you have religious extremists coming up. So all of these are a bit linked to the little political liberalization that ensued after the transition to civilian rule. So so it stems from all of that a bit. But in the north, things have not improved. You know about the what Boko Haram has done with the kidnap of almost 300 Nigerian schoolgirls. And the reprisals from the Nigerian army, even the way Boko Haram are going about things now is said, according to some analysts, to be linked to how the Nigerian army cracked down on them in the first place. So they were just, if you like, a loony Islamist group in, for starters.
In the beginning.
So in the beginning, they were just a loony group calling for Sharia. Nobody was going to take that seriously, that Nigeria will become a Sharia state. But the crackdown, the response by the Nigerian military and by the government, by the police, is said to have actually radicalized the group. So the group was formed in 2002 by a man called Mohammed Yusuf, and it was, as I said, just another group calling for Sharia and also saying Westernization is sacrilege and things like that, and against Western education. But things got really, really bad when the group's leader was extrajudicially executed by government authorities. So when that happened, the group went underground for some time, came back, promised vengeance, and that's why you have Boko Haram as you have it today.
Well, and it's a story that's repeated all around the world, isn't it? Repression just kind of breeds this kind
exacerbating things,
yes. Violence, yeah.
Oh, yes, it does.
Is there any light on the horizon yet there? Like, it would seem to me that the only answer is dialogue, so you have to get people talking, and they have to trust each other, and that seems a long ways away.
There has been some of that. The Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, has tried to go down that route. But I must say that's not a very popular route to go down in Nigeria at the moment. So he was talking about amnesty. So the armed groups in the south of the country, the Niger Delta groups who were complaining about the environmental degradation and things like that, they got their amnesty. They were armed groups and often violent and engaged in kidnappings and ransom taking and all of that.
Sure.
But they got their amnesty and things have kind of improved there. So some people are saying, look, it's a different situation when you're dealing with Islamic terrorists. So they don't want to apply the same logic. And they don't want the government to offer amnesty to Boko Haram. So that was on the table for some time. Amnesty was really on the table for some time. But now laws have been passed. Now, there are laws specifically declaring Boko Haram a terrorist organization. So that looks like it's probably off the table for a long, long time now.
So really, no prospect in the foreseeable future of any sort of compromise.
Well, compromise, maybe not. Eventual solution, eventual abatement, maybe, with the focus of the international community drawn to the issue of the kidnap of the schoolgirls. Maybe things can change. As you probably know, the U.S. Marines were sent in. The U.S. got involved with the struggle against Boko Haram. So with that kind of international involvement, who knows? Sometimes international involvement make things work worse rather than improve things. We'll see.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what they're really trying to achieve.
Yes, some people are worried that they might just be trying to get a foothold in Nigeria. So another military base in a very, very strategic part of Africa.
Yeah.
That's what some people think is going on.
Do you think it's overly optimistic or overly hopeful to think that in terms of American foreign policy, that they maybe are capable of getting the idea that the type of of involvement that they have been engaging in lately has made things worse in a number of situations. Iraq is a good example. Now we've got ISIS in there, and it's been argued that ISIS has basically been created by how the Western countries have been involved in that area of the world, and they've just made things worse.
Oh yes, I know what you mean. But another way of actually looking at these things is to see and to focus on the drivers of these policies, these foreign policies and international policies. Usually the drivers are economic. Okay, so the big corporations, if they're interested in the Western governments being there, in being in these places and intervening, they usually have their way. So many people may complain in Western countries about these Western involvements in all of these countries. But look, it's not just the politicians wanting to go there. They actually have economic drivers pushing them into all of these areas. So that's something that needs to be confronted head on as well.
I'm just going to shift gears here a little bit and talk about something a little bit different in Nigeria.
All right.
There's an informal settlement called Baja East. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
And apparently the government has been busy bulldozing it to make room for, paradoxically, new development for the people there. But in the meantime, the people who have their homes bulldozed are really not being looked after reasonably.
Yes, that's a problem. It's a problem that you have all of the time when governments want to develop areas. So I remember in the UK that being an issue with the gentrification of certain parts of Manchester. In countries like the UK, of course, there's so much more democracy and so much more respect for human rights that you will have more extensive consultation. In Badia East, there hasn't been a lot of consultation. Compensation is next to nothing. And I really do suspect that those new developments will not be for the benefit of the people that are being chased out of the places now. That's because when you gentrify places like that, the people that can actually afford to live there when mm-hmm. things are all nice and rosy
right.
will usually be the upper middle class.
Sure.
Okay, so people coming back home from Harvard with Harvard medical sure. degrees and the like, those are the people that will be able to live in places like that, not the poor and the downtrodden
who are being chased. Not the people that got pushed out.
No, not the people that got pushed out. So so they may say, oh, these new developments are for these people, but those people will not be able to afford those houses when they're built.
I've got a bit of a report from Amnesty that I got off the internet here, and the thing that I find interesting, that this is the World Bank is involved in this.
Oh, yes.
And on the 30th of September of last year, three affected people acting on behalf of the larger Badia community filed a request for inspection with the inspection panel of the World Bank. The inspection panel is a complaints mechanism for people who believe they have been or likely to be adversely affected by a World Bank-funded project to express their concerns and seek recourse. On the 16th of July of this year, despite being aware of the inadequacies of the RAP, and I'm not sure what that, I guess that's the project, the panel decided not to register the request. So the World Bank is not helping here.
No, the World Bank isn't helping, but they don't help also with the pieces of advice that they give developing countries about the economic route to follow.
Mm-hmm.
The usual prescription is let's have more liberalization, let's have more mm-hmm. privatization, and but all of these things have to
less spending by government.
Oh yes, less
austerity.
Public spending.
We need austerity.
Less public spending.
Yeah.
Deregulate. Don't regulate the major industries too much. Give them free rein. It's all about free markets and all of that. Well, we do need to monitor what these people are up to, because they are, after all, private companies.
Mm-hmm.
So those developments will be handled by private companies and private developers. We need to monitor what they're up to. We need to know that they're actually acting in the public interest while they're trying to do business.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's usually left out of this narrative of free enterprise and deregulate everything.
Right, yeah. Who are you really looking after? Are you looking after the public, or are you looking after your investors?
Oh yes, yes. That's the crucial question. And whose side is the government on the side of private investors and private companies, or are they actually looking out for the people?
Right, mm. right. Well, Stephen, we've covered a bit of ground here. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. We've got a few minutes left, and I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
This has been fun, and we could have probably gone on for a while longer.
Oh, yes.
I'm just going to mention here now, I think it's October 18th, that we have, we're hoping to have a provincial gathering of Amnesty, a provincial conference in Humboldt. So check our webpage for that.
Okay.
And I'd also like to put a plug in for our Tuesday night letter writing at Atlantis. We're doing a little different structure now, so you'll maybe see a few different people there from time to time. But everyone is welcome at Atlantis at 7 o'clock on Tuesday evenings to write letters. And you'd be surprised at the range of topics that you can write letters about. Some of them are Canadian, some of them are other countries, international, and we do have success stories, you know, where people do end up being able to, say, be released from prison or are able to avoid being executed and things like this. So thanks again, Stephen.
Thank you.
And we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."